Good afternoon and welcome to the November meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine by the wonderful Penobscot Bay. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience today. I'm Dick Snyder, a member of the Board of Directors of the Forum. Since 1985, the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the U.S., and to answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own rights. Details about past and coming programs are available at our website, www.midcoastforum.org. That's one word, midcoastforum.org. The Mid-Coast Forum is today honored to present Reza Jalali. Reza is a Kurd from Iran, a human rights and refugee activist who has lived in Maine since 1985. His essays, short stories, and commentaries have appeared in many local and international papers, and he has written for a number of books and video productions dealing with the plight of immigrants in the U.S. Reza's forthcoming book, God Speaks in Many Accents, is about the religions that Maine's immigrants have brought with them to their new home in the United States. He's just published a beautiful children's book about Ramadan entitled Moon Watchers. It's a perfect holiday gift that I highly recommend. As a member of Amnesty International USA Board of Directors, Jalali has led delegations to refugee camps in Turkey and Bosnia. And he's participated in numerous United Nations-sponsored international conferences in Korea, Japan, and Austria. In my role as the academic dean at Bangor Theological Seminary, I'm especially pleased to mention that Reza teaches Islam at the seminary, and he is the Muslim chaplain at Bates College as well. Let me mention to you that coming up after this day's presentation on December 6th at noon at Point Lookout, Stephen Kinzer will be speaking about RESET, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, carrying on the conversation from today's presentation. And in January on the 17th at Point Lookout, former Ambassador Nicholas Platt will speak about China-U.S. relations then and now, which will be a lead-in to the Camden Conference. So we're delighted to have you here, Professor Jalali, and we look forward to your comments today. Please, you're welcome here.
Salam, shalom, and as we say in Iran, Zohr Shama Bekhair. Good afternoon to you all. Thank you for including my voice in this timely and important discussion. The emergence of Iran as a regional power makes it more urgent that we get to know Iran and its people. And again, thank you for letting me add my assessment to this conversation. In order to put today's subject into some historic context, it's important that we go back years ago to decades ago when the United States, the new kid on the block, meets Iran, the home of Persian civilization and ancient culture that goes back to 2,500 years ago. The U.S. and Iran meet just as the Imperial British is losing its influence in the region, one superpower departing and an international powerhouse, the United States getting its feet wet in the turbulent, complicated, and mysterious currents of the Middle East, where loyalties shift, honor matters, the hostilities are timeless, and the ancient grievances are never forgiven. The initial relationship, like most marriages, started well, only to end in love-hate relationship and in ultimate separation years later. Many in Iran are fond of telling a story back to a particular chaotic time in Iran, in modern history of Iran, when the constitutionalists were challenging the royalists in order to minimize the influence of the royal court. They were attacked by the monarchists who were supported by the neighboring Russians, preferring the weak kings to the nationalists. This battle was in Tabriz in northwestern Iran. An American by the name of Howard Baskerville took up arms and died fighting the royalists in support of democracy in Iran. A graduate of Princeton University, he was in Iran teaching English and geometry. Many in Iran to this day honor and respect his memory. Similarly, Iranians over the age of 40 and older would speak of some with a sense of nostalgia of pre-revolution Iran when the streets, squares in Tehran were named after Roosevelt and Eisenhower and Kennedy. Starting in the 19th century, Iranians and Americans exchanged diplomats. The Americans helped establish schools and colleges in Iran, modeled after the universities in the United States. During the World War II, Iran was invaded and occupied by the British and the Russians. As part of the 1943 Tehran Conference, attended by Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, among many other pressing issues, the faith of New Iran was also discussed. The American encouraged the British and Russians to end the occupation of Iran once the war came to an end. The first sour point in the relation came about in 1951. The Iranians had elected a popular prime minister, a nationalist, by the name of Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, who in response to national aspiration demanded the nationalization of the oil industry in Iran, which was controlled by the British. Initially, Mossadegh had the support of the religious Shia scholars. He had the support of Tehran's Bazaar, Bazaar being the merchant class of Iran, as well as that of the Iranian Communist Party. The British government, which owned the Anglo-Iranian oil company, renamed British Petroleum, BP, had received concession to control the oil fields in Iran. The young Shah, fearful for his life, had already left Iran. The British government, angry with Mossadegh, convinced the U.S., the emerging power in the region, to intervene. But President Truman enjoyed a positive relationship with Dr. Mossadegh. But unknown to the president, the Central Intelligence Agency was busy starting a coup d'etat in Tehran. With the election of Republican Eisenhower to the White House, Mossadegh days were numbered. In August 1953, the CIA staged a military coup, a first for the agency, allegedly for a cost of $1 million, to replace Mossadegh with a general, and the king was invited back to rule. This was the beginning of the anti-American sentiment in Iran and the first chapter of the love-hate relationship between the two countries. While in America, the coup was initially seen as a triumph for the agency, in years to follow, it was considered to be a coup against, to be considered not only a mistake as it changed the course of Iran's future, but became a model for the U.S. foreign policy, particularly during the Cold War, when popular elected leaders would be overthrown in favor of military generals and dictators. Looking back, we might be able to say what happens in Tehran does not stay in Tehran. The coup would become the benchmark and the cornerstone of the foreign policy for years to follow. The U.S. supported Shah made a number of mistakes. In a rush to modernize Iran, a traditional society where change is unlikely to happen quickly, where religion and culture play important roles, the Shah wished to make Iran in the image of the West. Iranians were not against modernity per se, but the vision for modern Iran differed from the Shah's. In particular, two centers of power in Iran, the mosque and Tehran's bazaar, saw the influence decline in New Iran. Traditionally, the bazaaris, the powerful merchant class, and the Shia scholars and ayatollahs in Qom, a city of madrasas and religious schools and seminaries, have been the center of political influence. Shah's other mistake was to cause the opposition go underground. Let me give you some examples. In Shah's Iran as a teen, I could not read a book presumed by the secret police to be anti-government. I could not join a student group, write poetry which deemed to be anti-Shah, and so on. As a Kurd, as far as the Shah and his people were concerned, I did not exist. His intolerance for all political and most religious activities caused most Iranians, young and old, to seek refuge in mosques. In absence of any public spheres, neighborhood mosques became the safe place to meet. Perhaps this explains why mosques became the centers of power during the 1979 revolution. During Shah, Islam did not disappear. It just went underground. To most non-Muslims in the West, unfamiliar with the role of mosque, this seems strange. In Islam, mosques are more like a union hall, if you will, a meeting place, a neighborhood place where people could meet to talk about the daily things and discuss social and political and cultural issues. Of course, this would not be the first and only time the mosque had become the center of protest and opposition to the Iranian regime. In the late 19th century, Persia, when the British enjoyed much influence in Iran, then the Qajar king granted the imperial British the monopoly in growing and selling tobacco, somewhat similar to the tea business in the pre-revolution America. In 1890, Grand Ayatollah Shirazi issued a fatwa, a religious opinion, that banned the use of tobacco by Muslims in Iran. The nationwide protest succeeded in forcing the Iranian government to retreat. This victory of mosque and bazaar against the palace showcased the power of the Shia Ayatollahs and the bazaar. The tobacco protest, as it would become known, was a watershed in the history of modern Iran. Move forward to 1979 revolution, and you see lots of similarities. Oil becomes tobacco. The British imperial changes place with America. And the weak Qajar king is replaced by the Shah of Iran, suffering from cancer. The storming of the American embassy and taking the American diplomats as hostages led to the breakup of diplomatic relationship between the two countries. Looking back, many of us agree the hostage-taking was a heaven-sent gift to Ayatollah Khomeini. It allowed him to solidify his support base, get rid of his enemies, the moderates, the liberals, the very same groups who had helped him to overthrow the monarchy in Iran, while distracting the Iranians by accusing America of conspiracy against the young revolution. The rest, as they say, is history. But what's going on in today's Iran? Back this summer, I visited Iran, my third travel there since 2001. There were some obvious differences this time. Our plane landed in the new, modern steel and glass Khomeini International Airport. I imagine the new gigantic airport is built as a symbol of a new Iran, defiant and bold in the face of the international isolation and sanctions. I thought the fancy airport receiving international flights only was to make an impression on the few heads of state visiting Iran, and doing the same for the growing number of Asians, Arabs, and a few European business people willing to ignore the Western-sponsored sanctions and cash in on the lucrative market in Iran. Thanks to our SUVs and our growing national demand for cheap energy, there is no shortage of cash in Iran. On the way to Tehran for the new airport is built close to the highway connecting Tehran and Qom, the two seats of power in New Iran, the international traveler would see the large shrine built as a mausoleum for Khomeini. As most international flights arrive in Tehran late at night, the gold-plated dome of the shrine, modeled after the shrines built for imams, Shia imams in Iraq and Iran, glittered with green and gold light. Again, the statement being made was that the Islamic Republic, the Shia powerhouse, for Sunnis shy away from building shrines of any kind, was here to stay. And in the battle between the palace and the mosque has won big. You see, Iranian politics, domestic and foreign alike, is part symbolic, part real politic. The current leadership in Iran, a loose partnership of Shia hardliners and conservatives, the revolutionary guards that owns and runs most of the industries, manufacturing and importing goods from soap to fridges, cars, and chemicals, and merchant groups benefiting from the status quo, sees itself as the guardian of the Shia interest, regionally and globally. Overconfident with the knowledge that the U.S. is unwilling to challenge a regime militarily, and bold with the knowledge that two of its neighbors, Iraq and Afghanistan, are too broken to pose a military threat to it for years to come, and washed in wealth with the revenue from oil, this regime has some ambitions which could result in major repercussions for all involved, namely standing up to the U.S. by defiance in order to gain popularity in the Arab world, which is frustrated by its leadership's cowardice when it comes to dealing with the U.S. and Israel, challenging the Saudi Arabia's claim to leadership of Islamic world, Sunnis and all, support of Shia communities persecuted and outnumbered in most Muslim countries, among others. The means to reach these goals are more dangerous than the ambitions. They would include the alleged support of Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in the occupied territory, fighting proxy wars with Israel and U.S., and Saudis in Iraq and elsewhere, using groups that depend on Iran for military and financial support, and buying regional and international support by offering financial assistance to Shia mosques and organizations and poor Muslim countries everywhere. You are forgiven to want to ask two questions. Where does Ahmadinejad fit in all this and proxy wars between Sunnis and Shias? When did that start? Let me start with Ahmadinejad's job description. Many in Iran believe he is the loyal manager hired to run the front office. Forgive his barking, his quarrelsome language, his outrageous statement, and what you have is a manager granted incompetent who asks few questions and does the dirty work. Ahmadinejad, at least in his second term as a president, which many believe was given to him as a gift by the Supreme Leader Khamenei, as electoral abuses were alleged in 2009 presidential election, is a man with not much power. Most consider him as a front man for the faceless military-industrial complex run and owned by the Revolutionary Guards. Some even believe that Khamenei himself has not much influence as his son and the Revolutionary Guards run the show these days in Iran. True or not, one thing is crystal clear. When it comes to that Ahmadinejad lacks the power to declare a war on anybody or the final say when it comes to important foreign policy issues. Now, that's good news for all of us. According to the Islamic Republic's constitution, such powers rest with Khamenei himself. Now to the Sunni and Shia conflict. Thanks to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan and Iran, which removed the two bitter enemies of the Iranians in either side of the country, Iran has emerged as a regional power in the Middle East. Another unintended consequence of the war in Iraq has been the emergence of a Shia government in Baghdad with close ties to Iran. This unleashing of Shia power has made Sunni states panicky. If Iran could have been ignored due to it being a land of non-Arab Shias before, now the Arab Sunnis have to deal with an Arab Shia Iraq with plenty of oil and a friend of the U.S., at least for a foreseeable future. In years to come, many would believe that starting in the Middle East but spreading to the rest of the Islamic world after, the conflict of Sunni-Shia will capture headlines to such an extent that anti-Israeli and anti-American sentiment would pale in comparison. The Arab Sunni regime see the influence of Shiism, some call it the Shia Crescent, stretching from southern Lebanon to Bahrain, a threat to their power. Sunni governments in particular, the Arab states run by dictators, worry such a threat would ignite national aspiration for the large Shia communities who feel disenfranchised are poor in countries such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Pakistan, which has 30 million Shias. One wonders if that explains why the Saudis just signed the largest arms purchase with the United States. With Iran and Saudis, each government representing a different extremist narrative competing for the leadership of the Muslim world, a position held in the past by the mainstream and moderate Egyptians, the future of Islamic leadership is at stake. It's been many centuries since a Shia power has challenged a Sunni power. The last time the world witnessed this phenomenon was when the Shia Safavid dynasty in Iran competed with power with the Sunni Ottoman Empire. Saudi Arabia, not taking any chances, is busy establishing madrasas, religious schools, teaching the Wahhabi version of anti-Shiism, and seminaries around Iran to check Iran's ideological influences. To them, to the Saudis, Iran's ideological influences are more dangerous than its bombs. The conflict of Iran and Saudis may not be a bad thing for the U.S. In long run, a moderate, Western-friendly Iran can be a useful ally in checking the growing Wahhabi-influenced Al-Qaeda, Al-Shaban, and other Sunni violent terrorist groups targeting Americans. This might moderate the Saudis somewhat. After all, Iran is a non-Arab nation who, along with Turkey, another non-Arab Muslim state, and perhaps Shia Iraq, can perhaps counter the influences of the growing anti-American, anti-Israeli sentiment in the Arab world. In years to come, we know for sure the centers of political gravity in the Middle East are out to shift. Of course, the worst-case scenario would involve the U.S. government taking sides in the Sunni-Shia conflict by supporting the Saudis' ambition to speak for the Muslim world and losing Iraq, Iran, and the Shia's world support in the process. Back in the crowded, traffic-choked, and polluted streets of Tehran, I noticed another distinction with my past visits. And that's a level of open hostility ordinary Iranians display for the regime. Unlike the past, where the conversation in a public space would begin with hints, double talks, these days Iranians are more than willing to tell total strangers how they feel about the Ayatollahs. In most cases, the conversations would end with a promise that the days of the mullahs in power are coming to an end. Many in Iran would tell me the 2009 presidential election had made them distrust and resentful of the Ayatollahs because the regime faced with massive street protests demanding a new election. For most believe, the election results, if not stolen, would have gone in favor of Mir Hossein Mousavi, a reformer, responded by a level of violence unseen even by the Islamic Republic of Iran's standard. Many innocent civilians, including Neda Agha Sultan, a young woman whose death made headlines all over the world, were killed by security forces loyal to the regime. In Italy, a street has been named after Neda. And the government of Netherlands has published a special stamped picturing a smiling face in her honor. One other consequence of the alleged electoral abuse in 2009 election has been the loss of popularity for Khamenei, the supreme leader. With his open support of Ahmadinejad, Khamenei compromised the so-called neutrality of his position as a spiritual leader of Iran. For the first time, the slogan of death to dictator were heard not only in the university campuses, but in the streets and on rooftops in neighborhoods in Tehran and other major cities. While in Iran, on different occasions, I saw how nervous the government acted. For example, during a stretch of a few unusually hot days in Iran, in Tehran, when the temperature reached 102 Fahrenheit, the state announced the closing of all state agencies and offices for a few days to lower the demand on electricity. On a taxi ride to see a friend, a driver told me with excitement that Tehran Bazaar was on a strike, and that was the real reason for the state's decision. He went on to tell me how the regime has lost the support of the bazaars because of the Revolutionary Guard's policy of importing goods directly and the government's proposal to tax the bazaaris more. In a day, the strike reached the major cities of Iran, where some banks and state-owned offices were attacked. A week later, and Ahmadinejad's government backed away from its new tax proposal. As I mentioned earlier, in Iran, the mosque, the bazaar, and since the establishment of modern Iran, the university campuses have served as the three centers of opposition to regime. In most cases, whenever these three centers have joined forces, the regime has had no chance to survive. In today's Iran, two of the three, although for different reasons, have already joined hand in opposition. The third, the mosque, is still being controlled by the government, the exceptions being the Sunni mosques, mosques in Kurdistan, in the Arab-majority region of Khuzestan, and in Balochistan, and finally does mask loyal to Ayatollah Montazeri and other Ayatollahs opposed to the regime. Ayatollah Montazeri, a senior and respected scholar who had been under house arrest for past 25 years for his outspoken criticism of the regime, died last year. I had a chance to visit his hometown located outside of Isfahan, the ancient city of the Shia Safavid. The town of some 300,000 people, it's known for its high percentage of war casualties suffered, highest per capita among any city in Iran, all of them volunteers during the Iran-Iraq War. Outside a local bazaar and every mosque, Ayatollah Montazeri's portrait was on public display. A merchant told me, and I quote, "We love him and he is our spiritual leader," end of quote. I was told later that the regime would not allow displaying his pictures anywhere else in Iran, in a mosque, in a bazaar, anywhere. One major complaint I heard this time in Iran was how the regime has spent large sums of money in millions of dollars to governments of small and large countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to buy the support and vote should there be a showdown with the U.S. in the UN. The example given was how the regime had to spend a few billion dollars in Lebanon to repair the damages caused by the Israeli invasion. Once it seemed Hezbollah's military might against a more powerful Israeli army was gaining popularity in the Arab street, the Iranian regime saw an opportunity for winning some hearts and minds in Lebanon, whether Shias, Sunnis, or Christians. Iran offered to rebuild every bridge, school, and the homes destroyed by Israelis. This has made Ahmadinejad a hero in Lebanon, to the extent that his reception in his recent trip to Beirut was impressive. Many Iranians complained the aid to Hezbollah and similar gifts to Venezuelan government and others could have been put to better use inside Iran. Surprisingly, the issue of nuclear Iran was not a hot conversation item in Iran. For one thing, Iranians are too involved in trying to survive the inflation and the rising prices of everything from meat to sugar. The toll, of course, by the regime that the U.S. has sponsored sanctions are responsible for the rising prices and the inflation. In the markets, I could see most things were available, but for a much higher price as compared to my last visit. Iran these days imports most goods from China, Russia, and other countries. What most Iranians seemed to be concerned about was the expected expiration of government subsidy for much of what people needed. Unfortunately, many Iranians, including those who opposed the regime, agreed with the regime that Iran should be allowed to have a nuclear program, whether to make bombs or not. That came as a surprise to me. My guess is that the West made a mistake in framing the question of Iran's nuclear programs in such a way that it has become an issue of national pride for average Iranians. To understand the national passion Iranians have for nuclear bomb, one has to understand the identity crisis that Iranians deal with. Iranians have a sense of self-worth and self-importance made possible by their glorious past that sits in contrast with the reality of daily life. Isolated internationally, experiencing poverty for the first time, ghost of the Iran-Iraq war, which ended in humiliating Iranians, a sense that they are being misunderstood by the West and being included in the axis of evil, and compared to countries such as Somalia and North Korea. What I heard most was, and I quote, "We live in a dangerous neighborhood. If Jews, Hindus, and Sunni Muslims have the bomb, we should be able to have it too," end of quote. But what are some ways that the influence of Iran could be contained? While I agree some of the options may not be easy, I promise you most of them would have long-term positive consequences for the regime, for the region. Some would include, and I start by naming one, a couple of them. One would include the resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by forcing both sides to accept a two-state solution, something that most Palestinian public and some Israelis want. This in turn would sideline Hamas, and thus keeping Iranian hardliners out of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Additionally, a peaceful solution to Iraq's internal problems would both minimize the Iranian political influence in that country and also prove to the anxious Sunnis that Iraq would not become Iran's playground for mischief. Finally, the U.S. could and should, in my mind, normalize relationship with Iran by recognizing it as a regional power. Leadership comes with some responsibilities. Right now, Iran could act out, lash out at the states such as Israel, cause havoc, and walk away unaccountable to anyone. The hardliners in Tehran enjoy being punished by the West. More sanctions, let them come. More UN Security Council resolutions, warning of more serious punishments, who cares, they would say to their people. While in Iran, I heard this sentiment from those Iranians who are against the regime, yet unhappy with how the regime, and here you need to read The Nation, for in most cases, these two could be mistaken for one another. They were being treated by the Western in general and the U.S. in particular. And I quote, "We are a proud nation," they would say. "U.S. should recognize our importance in the region and respect us." The whining reminded me of the late comedian Rodney, what was his last name? Dangerfield, thank you. I would say, "I get no respect." Really, I was always reminded in Tehran of this late comedian. In conclusion, the hopeful signs for a new era where U.S. and Iran could be friends include the unusually favorable view of the U.S. that most Iranians, even many of those who support the regime, share. Iran, without a doubt, is one of the most pro-American nations in the Middle East. The U.S. is admired for its rule of law, its democracy, respect for human rights and rights of minorities, its technology, and of course, for its Hollywood. Most Iranians, thanks to satellite dishes, which are unlawful in Iran, get to watch the CNN, hear the Voice of America, the Farsi program, and host of other TV programs. For example, following the September 11th, Iranians gathered in defiance of their government to have candlelight vigils for the victims of the attack. These vigils were violently broken up by pro-government forces and the hardliners. Another example, an opinion poll in 2003 asking Iranians if they supported resuming government dialogue with the United States found 75% in favor. The pollsters were jailed, and at least one of them spent several years in prison. The youth in Iran watch in frustration the American lives they observe on the screens, computers and TV alike, but cannot experience for themselves. They want the same American life they like and dislike at the same time. This is a generation born in post-revolution Iran, and as such is removed emotionally from the revolution idealism. They want freedom and prosperity. What could help strengthen this favorable view would be some cultural exchanges, inviting Iranian journalists, writers, judges, musicians, sport teams, and so on. In general, even with all the security consideration we have to follow, it may make good policy to ease the travel restrictions on ordinary Iranians to make sure that we are and understand to make distinctions between them and their government. Years ago, after one of my trips to Iran, I wrote in an essay describing my visit, which was published in the main Sunday Telegram, and I mentioned my personal worries shared by many of how unrepresented American culture or American people were in Iran's society. The Russians, the Germans, the French, and others had the cultural offices, the libraries open to Iranians, and we were not there. We're still not there. We have been absent from the Iranian public, Iranian society for past 30 years. The harm in that is that the U.S. gets defined by the Islamic Republic officials, or somewhat equally harmful by awful and tasteless TV shows and sitcoms. Just imagine this great nation being introduced and defined by actions of individuals like Lady Gaga or Paris Hilton. We need to be there. We need to be there to tell our stories. Other hopeful signs include the makeup of the population. So many educated young section of the society look up at the West for inspiration. They like our democracy, and they can't wait to practice it. For example, there are 80,000 bloggers in Iran. The women in Iran, unlike some of their sisters in other parts of the Middle East, are making huge progress. Finally, while in the 1990s it was the Shia extremism that represented the dangerous and dark face of Islam to the West, starting on September 11, the enemy has become the Sunni extremism, from Al-Qaeda to Al-Shaban in Somalia and others, that pose a real danger to the U.S. In a twist of fate, the U.S. finds itself defending the Shias in Iraq, fighting an insurgency that feeds and is financially supported by the Sunni extremism. Indeed, Sunni extremism kills Westerners and other foreign nationals outside of the countries, but inside the borders, they prefer to kill Shias. Increasingly, to the Sunni extremism, Shias who support the U.S. policies in Iraq and Afghanistan are being seen as the American agents in the region. For example, the Saudi textbooks, which are anti-Semitic and are also an anti-American, are also equally hostile to Shiism. It's no secret that in Iraq and in Afghanistan, the U.S. and Iran share common security interest, as they both find themselves fighting the Sunni extremism version of Salafi and Wahhabi kinds. Sadly, the U.S.-Iran relationship continues to remain a hostage to the domestic politics here in the U.S. and political complexities in Iran. Just as Ayatollah Sistani in Iraq found common ground with the Americans, there are a few good Ayatollahs in Iran who might be able to help bring us together. The question, the timeless question is, where is a good Ayatollah when you need one? Thank you. I'm sorry for my soft voice. I'm just recovering from a cold, so my apologies if I At times, my voice broke.
Thank you very much, Reza. That was terrific, very informative, very insightful, and also somewhat hopeful in terms of the possibilities that you lay out. We have some questions here, and we're gathering more. First one, what do you think that Khomeini believes is Iran's national interest? What is rhetoric and what is real?
Inside Iran?
Mm-hmm.
We have to understand that Iran is a very complicated place. And as the presidential election of 2009 proved, and bear the fault lines in the society and the government, there's a faction between different elites within the state. So for that reason, it's really hard to know what exact narrative they offer. In many ways, it's really flavor of the week. But two, three messages have been consistent, that the U.S. is against Islam, that the U.S. is against Iran, that Israelis have some dark ambitions for the region, and they are a major threat to Iran as a nation. These have been consistent, but every now and then one changes and Russians become good, better people, and then the Chinese become better people or not. But in all said and done, these narratives again shift as the sands in the Middle East shift.
Another question, which conflict has more potential, in your judgment, to cause chaos in the Middle East and the world, the Sunni-Shia conflict or the Arab-Israeli conflict? And can the U.S. really influence either one? Can Iran influence either one?
By far, I as I suggested in my remarks, by far the Sunni-Shia conflict is going to be a more serious conflict. And much more than Israeli-Arab conflict. As I said in my remarks, the anti-American and anti-Israelis would take a back seat to what we see as the language is getting worse and worse. The anti-Shiism is very serious and unfortunate. The U.S., of course, can influence this conflict in a number of ways. Most of the Sunni states which support the anti-Shiism policies and express such sentiment are good friends of the U.S., starting with Saudi Arabia, which is the source of inspiration for Wahhabism and Salafi version of Islam, a very narrow and intolerant worldview of Islam. The U.S. can, of course, influence the outcome of this conflict by perhaps forcing the Saudis to calm down and also asking the same from other Sunni regimes. But as I mentioned during my remarks, what the tension within Islam these days is serious, that now we see a conflict not only between Shiism and Sunnism. That's a different story, is also a conflict between moderate Islam, which is pro-West, which is not anti-Christian, anti-Judaism, anti-anything, much more tolerant, and the Wahhabi version of Islam, which again is very intolerant. This tension is going on within the Sunni societies of Muslim countries as well. I think Thomas Friedman called it the fight between desert Islam and urban Islam, which I really like that term. And the question is which one would win, the desert Islam being the Wahhabi version and the urban Islam being the Islam, which is practiced in places such as Cairo. Or Karachi, or perhaps some cities in India, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, in the Philippines, where Muslims manage to live in harmony with people of other faith.
Thank you. Should we be concerned about Iran obtaining nuclear weapons?
Yes, personally, my view that yes, we need to be concerned, but we have to be careful that if we frame the question in such a way that they can never have it, then perhaps we would make it much more possible for them to have it. We have to be careful that we don't allow the hardliners to have the narrative, the final say on this issue. We really need to find it easy for average Iranians, for the public in Iran, which, by the way, is very much connected to the international news or what goes on outside of Iran. Unlike the, say, former Soviet Union, unlike the closed societies of the past where the dictators had monopoly on information, Iranian regime has lost that monopoly. Thanks to, again, internet and satellites, Iranians get to hear what we say about them and what we write about them. And for that reason, it's really important to prove to average Iranians that this is, we understand the issue of national pride, but this is that perhaps the energy, the resources can be spent in a much wiser and better way to build more schools, more bridges, more roads in Iran, rather than spending the money on a bomb just so that to scare the Saudis and others.
There's a question here that shifts the focus from the Middle East to the Western Hemisphere. Is there validity to the speculation that Iran will subsidize an effort with Nicaragua and Venezuela to build a canal in Nicaragua that will compete with the Panama Canal? And if so, what implications arise from this goal? You have any wisdom on that?
I don't. I love the short answers like this. I don't.
Good.
I'm sorry.
No, I didn't think there would be an answer. Since the Revolutionary Guard control the economic fate of Iran, how can the secular youth of Iran, and indeed some of the religious youth as well, gain political control? The religious leaders use the Revolutionary Guard to hold power over the people. Is there a military element in Iran that will support the will of the people? Is there a counter-revolutionary or a counter-military group?
No. Most, as we saw during the 2009 presidential election, all the protests, without any exception, were nonviolent. One reason for in absence of any militant group to support and help the civilians stand up to the regime. There is no such group, but Iranian youth and even other section of the society are determined to fight this regime with nonviolent means. Again, if you go back and look at the street protest during the 2009 presidential election, summer of 2009, you see that in one demonstration, one single case, we had almost 2 million Iranians who silently marched across Tehran from one end of Tehran to another. And the regime tried to provoke them. The regime tried to cause them to become violent. And people had the discipline to remain calm and silently march. The demand was that to have another election. And how does the regime react? Of course, with violence. And hundreds of people were killed, and thousands of people, tens of thousands of people were arrested, some of them never to be seen. But Iranians are determined to continue fighting for their rights, and I have every reason to remain hopeful that that would happen.
A final question that perhaps is one that is informative for most of us. You began to speak about this a little bit. It's a question that parallels the religious reality within the United States among Christians on the right and Christians on the left, fundamentalists and liberals and so forth. In your opinion, what is the basic difference between Shia and Sunni versions of Islam? And is this worth the animosities that exist between the two?
How much time do we have? How many days? Never mind about the lunch. Let's Let's ask for some bids and. Again, we have to be careful. There's diversity within Islam. So I'm careful not to put Shias in one box and Sunnis in one box. So as you can imagine, there are secular, mainstream, Sufi Sunnis, very tolerant. And same applies to the Shias. There are Shias who are not conservative, who are not hardliners. And I hesitate to call either of the groups fundamentalists. As Muslims, we are all fundamentalists. We cannot be non-fundamentalists. So that's a term that, but that's a different conversation, how that term is being misused in the West by non-Muslims. But hardliners are present in both camps. And hostility between the extremists on both sides is over the leadership of the Muslim world, and also who speaks for the true Islam. So the question has always been, the Shia hardliners say, we are the real Muslims. Our imams were related to the Prophet himself by blood, and the Sunnis, of course, would disagree. The tension between these two groups is now much more political than theological. It's become now cultural. Unfortunately, these two groups are busy throwing bombs at each other's mosque. And the Wahhabi version coming out of Saudi Arabia and other Sunni places, such as the Taliban rule Afghanistan or the rural parts of Pakistan, is not helping the matter.
Professor Jalali, thank you very much for this wonderful, insightful. Great, really great.